Hello and welcome to the Religion Media Centre podcast. I'm Ruth Peacock and this week I'm hosting a debate on the 10th anniversary of Pope Francis. Our panel discusses the headlines from the first decade, his achievements, successes and challenges. Joining us on the call, we have a distinguished panel, Christopher Lamb, the Vatican correspondent for The Tablet, journalist and author, Professor Anna Rowlands from the University of Durham, the Bishop of Salford, John Arnold, Kerry Webber, who joins us from America Magazine in New York, so thank you for getting up early for this today, Kerry, and Father Damien Howard, the Principal Superior of the Society of Jesus. So thank you all for joining. And I think the best thing is perhaps you all know each other individually, but to introduce you to each other and to the people on the call, perhaps I can just field a few questions or ask a few questions of you as you introduce yourselves. So Christopher, perhaps I can start with you. Vatican correspondent for The Tablet, journalist and author of a book about Pope Francis. Perhaps you could say, first of all, how do you think in the first 10 years Pope Francis can be remembered? What are his successes and achievements in the first 10 years?
Well, thanks, Ruth. I think the first thing that comes to mind when we look on this pontificate is this is an outsider pope. And that was the title of my book, The Outsider. And, you know, I remember almost 10 years ago standing in St. Peter's Square waiting to see who the cardinals had elected, and Pope Francis appearing. And it was a huge surprise. The name Bergoglio, when that was read out, I remember people in the square around me saying, "Who is he?" And I think what is striking about this Pope, as I said, is first of all, his outsider status. Very few people predicted him to be elected. And so I think as the Pope, he has, as the outsider, associated his papacy with the outsiders. He is constantly called for a missionary church, a church that goes to the margins, church that goes out of its comfort zone. I think to some degree he's achieved that. I think he's certainly achieved a reform of the papacy, just in the simple things, the living arrangements, decision to live in the Casa Santa Marta rather than the Apostolic Palace, his simple and humble lifestyle. He, I think, is trying to draw the church back to the gospel, the fundamentals. It's a gospel-based reform. And I think that is at the heart of what he's trying to do. And, of course, it's also about implementing the Second Vatican Council. I can't unpack all that now. He has faced resistance and he has faced difficulties, and I've written about that in the book. But, you know, to broadly speaking, he's the outsider pope who's reformed the papacy and is taking the church out of its comfort zone.
Perhaps I can go to Father Damien Howard next. He is a Jesuit, and I read somewhere that it was easy to mistake him for a Franciscan, giving his emphasis on outcasts. I wonder if you could just explain the importance that it was for Jesuits for him to be elected in the first place, and how the fact that he's a Jesuit has come across during his first 10 years.
He's the first and only Jesuit Pope in the history of the Church. When he was chosen, it was an immense surprise to us because I think we never expected a Jesuit to be the Pope. He has a fairly complicated relationship with the Society of Jesus. I mean, he was a very fervent Jesuit and ended up in the job that I had only in Argentina. He was provincial of the Jesuits in that country under a military dictatorship, and that he did at a very young age in his 30s. So he had this extraordinary experience of dealing with all the delicacy of a totalitarian regime very early on. I think that gave him a very particular sensibility about leadership. I think that's one of the remarkable things about his pontificate, frankly, is his style as a leader. And I think that does derive very heavily indeed from his identity as a member of a religious order, partly as a Jesuit, yes. But to be honest, I think you put your finger on it by saying there's something very Franciscan about him too. I think there ought to be something very Franciscan about Jesuits too, but that's my own view. In other words, there's a great humility built into the way he thinks about leadership. The model is Jesus Christ, and the model is one of humility, simplicity, servant leadership. And I think one of the astonishing things is that he emerges after 10 years in a really polarized world, having had to deal with the most appallingly difficult and complex situations, still with a reputation for gentle boldness, ethical coherence, and the ability to articulate a compelling moral vision which addresses the whole planet. And I think that is very much to the heart of what you're talking about.
What about theological rigour? That's something that you would associate with Jesuits. Do you associate that with the Pope?
Yes and no. I mean, he's preceded by a philosopher in the shape of Pope St. John Paul II, and a, you know, absolutely top level theologian in the person of Pope Benedict XVI. So it would be asking a bit much to expect anybody to match those kind of credentials. And he is not an academic philosopher or theologian. On the other hand, he has a very strong interest in those subjects, and he's developed his own clear and rather idiosyncratic discourse in those two areas, which he has brought to bear in his teaching documents. Is it theologically rigorous? Well, I probably aren't the right person to answer that question. I'd refer you to Anna Rowlands, who'll have a much clearer take on that. But it's certainly very creative and I think very compelling and quite unusual. I think he's been very creative and made a great contribution.
Thank you. Well, cue to you, Professor Anna Rowlands, from the University of Durham. Your full title, St. Hilda Associate Professor of Catholic Social Thought and Practice in the Department of Theology and Religion. So I suppose the same question to you. Will he be remembered for his work as a theologian?
I think, interestingly, and I can say this as an academic theologian, Pope Francis has not got a lot of time for academic theology. And what he's interested in is a different kind of theology. He worries that theologians like me have a lack of urgency in the way that we work on topics. And I think that for Francis, there is this absolute sense of timeliness and urgency about his papacy that demands a different kind of set of theological dispositions from, say, the theological dispositions which he might associate either with the academy in formal terms or even with somebody like Pope Benedict. So it's about a different kind of theological set of dispositions. And I suppose one of the things that he's tried to do is recast the Pope as theologian on the world stage in several ways. First of all, I think by gesture rather than word. So a key part of what he's done is take himself to sites of crisis and of suffering in the world and to place himself as a witness to that suffering and to speak theologically into those places. And crucially for him, to listen to the theology that emerges from those sites. And he believes very strongly, I think, that our key theological sites for meaning making in the church right now are particularly in the majority world, in the global south, and amongst the most marginalized communities. So he's interested in this relationship between center and periphery, and that every center has its periphery. So he uses this polyhedron image. And he wants theology done within that polyhedral structure. So I think it's very naive when people argue, and people do argue, that he is a sort of anti-theological pope or that he's poorly trained or that it's naive theology. I think they mistake the kind of theology that he's trying to do. And the important thing to do is to pay attention to that. The second area where we see this is obviously, and Chris alluded to this already, is in relation to the synod process and his renewal of ecclesiology. He is determined, again, with a great sense of urgency, to embed the reforms of the Second Vatican Council within the life of the church from the bottom up. So not to have another gathering that simply attempts to cascade documents downwards in a top-down change management fashion, but rather to animate the grassroots of the church in an engagement, encounter, accompaniment, participatory manner, so that so that people get a taste and a feel for the Church of Vatican II, rather than simply a sort of cognitized message of that. And that's very clever. It's very clever. And in that context, he's unafraid of chaos and he's unafraid of conflict. But there are two things that he is afraid of, and they are basically the spiritual temptations that he thinks that we face as a generation. The first is the danger of polarizing and adding polarization upon polarization. And the second is of indifference. And by indifference, he means the tendency to detach ourselves spiritually from the urgent questions of our age. in a way, I don't think you can get more theological in terms of diagnosing the spiritual ills of our moment and also welcoming the possibility for a renewal through encounter and accompaniment, particularly in sites of marginalisation. So that's where I would see the theology of Pope Francis.
Thank you. Well, perhaps I can move on to Kerry now, Kerry Webber from New York. Kerry, just to explain for the UK audience, you're executive editor of America magazine. Just tell us a little bit about the magazine, first of all.
Sure. It's a national magazine here that is published by the Jesuits of the United States and Canada. And we cover topics at the intersection of the church and the world, is what we like to say, which is where the Jesuits often exist themselves, that interpreting the church for the world and the world for the church. And so we can cover any range of topics, and that's from, you know, Vatican politics to a Netflix series. So we're all that whole spectrum.
Thank you. I just wonder, as you were listening to Professor Anna Rowlands just then, your reflections on this, because you actually met the Pope, didn't you? You interviewed him at the end of last year, is that right? With other colleagues from the magazine. Does Professor Rowlands' reflection on how he does theology, does that match with your understanding of how he sees his mission and role?
Yes, I found myself nodding quite a bit while Professor Rowland was speaking. Our experience in meeting Pope Francis through the interview that America did with him in November was really powerful from both a personal faith perspective and from trying to get a good perspective on the church globally and the church in the United States. And one of the things that he specifically said, which touches on Professor Rowland's comments, is that polarization is not Catholic. He does not want us to be moving further apart because of arguments around the church or politics. But unfortunately, in the U.S., there is a lot of polarization right now, and a lot of it is along the lines of politics, and that aligns with certain issues in the church as well. And it's been a real struggle for a lot of faithful. And he really, I think, in that interview and throughout his papacy, has continued to try to call everyone back together, to try to say, like, look, we need to be united around bringing people in from the margins, around the Eucharist, around the conversations that we need to have together to have a more fruitful experience in the church. And that's messy. That is messy, as was mentioned. So the synod is part of that. And we sort of see the ways in which those conversations play out.
I just wonder whether anyone is taking heed of what he says about the need to move away from polarization, because we read over here that there are some vicious critics of him in the States. And I wonder if that's getting worse or better as his papacy continues.
It does not feel like it's getting better. I hope that it will. I hope that the Holy Spirit will guide us in that direction and that people can start to listen. I think because some of it is around church politics and or church traditions, but some of it is also aligned with sort of entrenched political beliefs. And the combination of those two things makes it really hard for people to speak with each other in charity right now, I think. And I wish that it didn't. I wish that it were different. But if anything, though, the church is the one place that can bring us back together, because it involves us looking at the person in front of us before the politics. It involves us looking at that call to communion over the call to division. It involves all of those the gospel call to mercy, right? To look at one another through a merciful lens, to minister to one another. And when you do that, the politics become secondary. The arguments within the church become secondary. But it's hard to get past that. It's hard to get to that spot. People are very emotional about these things. And it often, you know, has an impact on the issues that people are arguing about are not also totally theoretical, right? There's issues that have an impact on someone's experience at Mass or their experience in their family, or whether or not their brother and sister are accepted in their parish community or in their family or wherever. So it's high stakes. And so it, people have very strong emotions around it. And that when you get heightened emotions, it's hard to respond in charity. But remember, having Pope Francis continually call us back to that hopefully helps.
Thank you very much. And Bishop John Arnold, if I can come to you next. You are the spokesperson on the environment for the Bishops' Conference in England and Wales. I'm just wondering, listening to all the contributions so far and talking about the Pope's idea of a mission, Laudato Si was a very important document that came out some time ago, quite early in his papers. Can you just run us through the importance, as you see it, of tackling climate change for the Pope?
Well, I think he's made it into a universal question of urgency. And I think he's done a great deal to wake the world up, not just the members of the church, but he's gone to, his address to all people of goodwill. And it certainly is the most published encyclical ever, I understand. He's brought it to the headlines, and that's vitally important. But he's tied it up with everything else he says everything is connected. That means each and every one of us has our part to play, and that we're in this together, and we've got to wake up to what it means. And I think he's been prophetic in that, and it underlies so much else of what he's doing. What more can I say? I think it's a leading subject for him, but he's made it a leading subject for the world.
Just to draw it back to Catholics in this country, in England and Wales, you're the Bishop of Salford. People think in your diocese of the Pope?
I think generally very much in favour of what he's doing, that he's taking a fresh look at things. To call us all missionary disciples and to say that, our faith is something that we've got to put into action. It's not just a spiritual thing in our lives. We've got to be responsible day by day for the decisions that we make, for the good that we do, that we go right back to that passage in Matthew's gospel. What's the most important commandment of the law is to love God with your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And the second resembles it, to love your neighbour as yourself. And we can all do that every day. And I think that's something that's impacting, I hope, throughout this diocese. I certainly get the feeling that action is something that people want to see, be part of, and to recognise what they can do as Catholics in making the world a better place. And that sense of care for our common home and our brothers and sisters, particularly in these days of financial stress in this country. Salford is the Greater Manchester area, and we've got these horrendous statistics about 42% of children in Greater Manchester are living in poverty. That's appalling in the fifth most prosperous nation in the world. I think he's getting us to think about that and to act accordingly and to react to a serious situation.
Just one more question, if I may, before we open it up and start talking about some of the issues, and just encourage all the journalists to put questions in the chat box. So just picking up from Kerry's magazine interview with the Pope last year. So he was asked a question about what ordinary Catholics in America think of the Conference of Catholic Bishops. And 20% said that they found the conference to be very trustworthy. And his answer was, the bishop's conference is not the pastor. The pastor is the bishop. I just wonder what you think, what your view of the Pope's view of clericalism is. And do you feel supported by the Pope? Does he support people in clerical positions and the Conference of Bishops in England and Wales, for example?
I think that he's reminding us that clericalism is inappropriate when it sets the priest or the ordained person anyway above the people. He's got that wonderful example, hasn't he, that a bishop's got to be in three places. He's got to be out in the front leading by example. He's got to be in the middle of his those in his pastoral care, among the sheep, getting the smell of the sheep. And he's got to be behind, making sure that no one gets left behind. And I just think that he's reintroduced and emphasized very strongly that ordination is to service of the people. And that's something that we've got to constantly remind ourselves about, that we are there to serve people, to encourage them, to help them to develop their faith, to see their faith as a practical way of living. In that way, I think the bishops would see that we are there to serve the people in our pastoral care.
Thank you. Thank you very much as an introduction to everyone on the call. And I wonder now if we could start going through some of the issues that some of you have raised already in your points and bring in questions from journalists. But I would encourage you to talk about this with each other. So the first issue I would like to concentrate on is synodality, this word synodality and what it means. And perhaps Professor Rowlands, you could kick us off on this, because whenever we talk about it as democratization, but we're slapped down and we're told that it's not democratization, but it is about giving voice to everybody in the church. So can you just explain that to us? What does it mean, and what has he done, and how successful has the Pope been in this venture?
So one of the reasons why I think that democratization is the wrong phrase for thinking about the synod is that, in essence, what the synod is attempting to do is construct, in the instance of this synod, the largest participatory grassroots process in the history of the Catholic Church. It's an attempt to draw into participation, to draw into encounter, to draw into collective spiritual discernment, the moment that we're living in. And the role of the synod is to be advisory, in essence, to the Pope through the bishops. And so the role of the synod itself is this massive grassroots participatory process. And I think it's much better to think of it in that sense. And this is something which was touched on a little bit by what Bishop Arnold was saying. Pope Francis genuinely believes that we need to re-receive the idea of the dignity of all of the baptized, that every single baptized Christian has a role to play in the life of the church, in the governance of the church, in a differentiated way. So not in a homogenized way, but in an appropriately differentiated way. Now, synods are not new in the history of the church. Arguably, the early church had absolutely loads of them. And I think Pope Francis has been interested in reviving that tradition of synodality in the life of the church. He's had synods on the family, on youth, the Amazonia synod. So this new synod process, synod on synodality, is helping the church to learn again how to be a community of all the baptized, how to be the people of God. And in that context, we've just reached the end of a very long process of the listening phase of the synod, where we have listened globally across each country, each region, and now up to the global level. We've listened to the experiences of grassroots Catholics, and we're moving now gradually into a phase where there will be a discernment of that listening. And that's what will happen in October this year, when the world's bishops and many others gather together in Rome to really reflect together on the fruits of that process. Over the last month, every continent has met to discuss the fruits of the initial listening phase and to draft a document in response to that. So it's chaotic, it's huge, it's messy. There's been all sorts of problems with it. But nonetheless, it's the most alive and vital thing that's happening right now within the global church.
So there's a question in the chat box from Adam Berry.
Thanks, Ruth. What needs to happen to make the synodal conversion stick? I noted your words about urgency and about the need to sort of move things forward. And I think this process is moving quickly in many regards, in many respects. But sort of the longer term sustainability of the changes that are promised here, what needs to happen to help those stick?
So one of the things that, and this is a sort of controversial point, I suppose, but one of the things that I would say in reflection on thinking about the different continental meetings of the last few months is that this is a question which is more European and North American than it is Asian or African and so, or Oceanian. The big problems for a culture of synodality and for real tensions and polarizations are between near neighbours within regions in Europe and North America. And they are much less the church in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, Oceania. Yeah. In those contexts, it's really clear to me that people are saying, and this is what's already in the documents that are emerging publicly from that process, but nonetheless, those contexts are basically saying, we already practice this in our cultures. This is not an alien way of thinking and being for us. And in fact, is the rest of the church, particularly the European church, ready for us to teach synodality? So I think this is a very context-specific set of questions in terms of the stickiness of it and the sustainability. And it precisely illustrates that flipping of the church under Francis towards the global majority context.
There was a report that Catholic women had done to suggest in their survey that there was a universal appeal for women to be valued as equal members of the church. And I wonder, Professor, if you think that this is unleashing all kinds of forces from the grassroots within the Catholic Church, which could ultimately lead to women's ordination.
We have no idea where the process will lead, and I think it's really fruitless to second-guess that discernment process. So I won't do that, not for reasons that it's controversial, but because the openness of this process must be maintained. However, there is a sense, and this came across in numerous reports, including from contexts where you wouldn't necessarily have expected it, of people saying, this is the first time in my life, and I never thought I would live to see this moment, where the church has genuinely wanted to hear about my experience and my views. I never thought I would be consulted in this way. So the unleashing that you describe is a much more positive process, as it were, of people feeling heard, that there is an interest in the experiences and the views and the spirituality of ordinary Catholics. And that absolutely has included an emphasis on women's experience, and the failure to hear that, and a call for women's participation in wider structures within the church, as well as the accompaniment of women in their lives in relation to the socioeconomic issues, which also Bishop Arnold was noting before. So it isn't just a looking inwards question that women were raising about their own participation. It's actually a question about the socioeconomic realities of the lives that women are living across the globe, and the capacity of the church to be active witnesses and accompaniers of women in those contexts.
Yes, I hear what Anna says, but I have great admiration for Pope Francis when it comes to his concerns about the planet or the traumas of refugees. And thank God we've got somebody speaking up for them. But I don't find the idea that he's sympathetic to women that convincing. I mean, he runs the largest patriarchy in the world, I find it problematic. I don't feel as if we've made enough progress in seeing women afforded the respect they should be within the church and its decision making. It's all very well saying a few nuns have been appointed to places in the Roman Curia, but I'm not sure that's really enough. Do we just have to accept that he's an elderly Argentinian gent who's not going to change his ways and continue to think of us as the strawberries on the cake, as he once described women? Or is it because he thinks the church isn't ready to develop further? And he would like it to, but he just doesn't think this is the moment. And if so, when is the moment?
So, Catherine, just to be clear, my comments were about what was emerging from the synod process as opposed to specifically what Pope Francis himself is doing. But on the question of what he's doing, I think it's a tale of two cities. So I think the truth is it remains a significantly patriarchal institution in exactly the ways that you've described. And many of Pope Francis's own comments sometimes on women are fairly essentializing, and some would find them kind of patronizing that he is a man of his culture and age. But I don't think we can overlook the fact that there is genuine material progress in terms of the inclusion of women in governance roles within the Vatican. And also, interestingly, as far as I know, he's the first pope to request that encyclicals are produced in inclusive language. Now, that doesn't always cascade through all the translations, particularly the English translations of those documents. But nonetheless, his own request is for those documents to be produced in inclusive language. So it's imperfect. It's a tale of two cities, but we need to pay attention to kind of both sides of that.
And what's happened to the studies of women joining the diaconate? Has that just got weighed down, lost in bureaucracy? What's happened to it?
No, that's not got lost, and that conversation is ongoing, and the National Synod reports pointed to the question of women deacons as a matter for serious debate and discussion.
He must have initiated that after an appeal from women religious about 6 years ago?
There have been two committees. So the first one was after the Women Religious, and then the second one was the commission was restarted after the Amazon Synod. And as far as I know, that commission is still in existence, but I don't know what's been happening. But I think what Anna's saying about the synod and the diaconate, because if you were to look, say, take the question of the female diaconate as aside from priesthood, there's a different theological question there. Cool. That is something that the synod process can focus attention on and potentially move forward. I don't think the Pope is going to make a change to the diaconate, women diaconate, based on a commission. I think that's basically where he's come down on. I think he will want to see what's the consensus. If there's a consensus in the synod process around something like the female diaconate, then, well, that Francis is there to affirm that consensus. Because I think that's how his leadership has been in terms. He has really been quite radical when it comes to the pastoral approach, but doctrinally he has kept things. He's not touched the big questions of doctrine. Of course, he believes that doctrine develops. He sees Catholic tradition as a living thing, but he's not someone who's going to say, "I, the Pope, am going to change this long-held view with the swipe of the pen." And that potentially could create even more problems. Effectively, a pope could say tomorrow, "Well, I'm going to ordain women." The next pope comes along and says, "You've gone against tradition. We're going to cancel it." What Francis has done, what I think, and I think this is much more strategically astute, is it's open processes. So you go step by step, incrementally. I'm not saying he's got some, big goal to do X, Y, and Z, and this is all some cunning plan, but I think he generally says, what is the process by which we can ensure there's incremental, step-by-step, irreversible renewal? And that's how I think he's doing it. But if he just sits there and says, I think, from my understanding of how I've seen things happen in the Vatican, if he used to say, right, we're going to do this big thing, with the stroke of a pen, and sometimes he can be very decisive, and he is willing to be, very firm. But on something like a very contested topic, I think he's concerned that will be overridden in the future. I think it's about ensuring the reforms are irreversible.
What Christopher said there is very important, but there's a word I think that really needs to be introduced here into the discussion and understanding of synod. And that's discernment, because I think even when we talk in the way that we just did, we might give the impression that somehow Francis is brilliantly strategically setting up a consensus, which will then take over. Francis is perfectly able to see a consensus and say, this is not the work of the Spirit. Therefore, it's not something we should follow. And I think really to understand what synod is about means getting radically away from the democratic idea that Anna's already alerted us to. This is a spiritually, potentially transformative event in the life of the church. And if it goes well, it's not that it will deliver certain reforms that you or I may think desirable. It will lead to something that surprises us. It will lead to something that amazingly brings together people who thought that they were fundamentally opposed into a kind of agreement and a new vision, which brings new life and freshness to the life of the church. That's what this is all about. And the only way you do that is not by voting or shouting loudest or maneuvering or strategizing. It's by listening out for the voice of the Holy Spirit at work. And that's something we call in the tradition of the church, very ancient practice, particularly from monasticism, the discernment of spirits. It's quite hard to teach in a few minutes, actually, in a few years. So I'm not even going to get into it in this call. But I think without it, we really just don't get what synodality is aiming at. And that's why this is going to take a long, long time, because learning discernment is the work of years and decades. It's barely even begun, I think, in many of the little synodal exercises I've taken part in.
I don't suppose I'm the only bishop who, within days of the announcement of the Universal Synod, received a number of letters and emails from the right and the left saying the synod must decide this, must decide that, and they'd got the wrong idea entirely as to what the synod should be about. And I think this synod because it's the first universal synod, it won't be a complete success, but I think it's going to set us on a way in which we need to be reminded about discernment. I agree entirely with Father Damien there. And it's going to take time, but we're going to follow up in this diocese with our own diocesan synod. And I think that we'll be much better placed to have that synod because of the experience of the universal one. But learning to discern what the Spirit is saying to the churches today is going to take time. But I think it's wonderful that he's giving us that opportunity. And I think it's timely in the world in which we live, in all the changes and the challenges that face us at the moment, that we should be thinking, praying, travelling together to discern the best way of meeting those challenges.
Perry, just a question for you. Is there anything in the synodical process that has created the, if you like, conversely, the venom of the opponents of the Pope? I mean, I was reading somewhere that there's always opposition, there's always anger, but there is venom associated with opposition to this Pope, and I wonder what you think is the main reason for that.
So I think part of the beauty of Pope Francis's pontificate is that he's opened up the church for conversation. He's made people feel, I think, freer to speak their mind about issues in the church. And so that means that I have the chance in that interview to go that we did in America to go into Casa Santa Marta and ask the Pope about women's ordination. And that is a question that he will answer for me, right? And that is part of the openness to these conversations, that it's a little messy and that it's, but let's talk about it. If it's causing somebody pain in the church, let's talk about it. But I think it also has emboldened some people who feel like, because these conversations are not being clamped down on, they can speak their mind in other ways that are less charitable and more venomous, as you say. And I think it's unfortunate, but it's also sort of a natural byproduct of that openness in some ways. Like it's just, when you say, let's have it out, people are going to have it out. And hopefully he can continue to call people back to that charity. Hopefully we can have these conversations in a prayerful manner, that we remember like what we're talking about. It's not just church structures or politics, it's people, right? And that's the real heart of what Francis wants to bring us to, is the person in front of us, right? That we are going to see that person, individual persons, one at a time. And through those conversations and through those connections, create a better global church as well. But I think a lot of times it's easy to forget that person and just think of somebody as almost a representation of an idea that you dislike, or as, you know, I think when Pope Francis's pontificate started, he shocked everybody by doing all these things that people didn't associate with the Pope, right? You know, riding the bus with everybody else, carrying his own suitcase, getting a little small car, all these sort of moments of humility. And I think that was really relatable for a lot of people. And so I think a lot of people in their minds thought, good, he's going to be the kind of Pope that I want, whatever their political background. That was so universal that he could say, great, this is going to be my Pope. He's going to do what I want. And then when Pope Francis refused to be pinned down by any particular political wing or section of the church or whatever, everyone started to get a little uneasy. Like, wait, I don't understand. I like that part of him, but this part makes me uncomfortable. And that's what he's there for. He's there to affirm us, and he's there to make us a little bit uncomfortable. And that's his job. And we should accept that. Discomfort, there can be a lot of anger.
I think I'd be a little bit more suspicious about some of those things. I think there are some serious moneyed interests, not least in the United States, people who have quite a lot to lose by the sorts of policies and directions that Pope Francis is suggesting. And I think an awful lot of vitriol comes from fairly well-coordinated and indeed well-funded lobby groups who are rather alarmed at what's happening to some of their interests. I think that needs to be factored into.
Building on what Father Damien's saying, I completely agree. There is a difference between criticism of the Pope, which is legitimate criticism, which I think Francis has opened up by saying, you know, I'm a sinner, and he's admitted mistakes, first Pope to actually admit personal mistakes in a public way. And there is criticisms that can be made of Francis when it comes to the handling of the sexual abuse crisis, and I'm sure there are other mistakes that we could point to. But there's a criticism that can be made of the Pope, and then there's a distinction between the attacks that are about, I would say, trying to destroy this pontificate, and those are often politically driven, and they, in a sense, it's a rejection of this Pope, the authority of this Pope. That's a different thing, and that's a phenomenon we've seen emerge during these last 10 years, which I think is unprecedented in many ways. And it is driven by majority in the English-speaking Catholic world because of the megaphones that some people have in the Catholic media. So I think we should distinguish between the criticisms of Francis and the attacks that are actually about trying to reject and resist him.
Thank you. We've talked a lot about the internal workings of the Catholic Church and his influence on that. Can we just look at his influence on the world? So you have mentioned in your earlier conversations refugees. We haven't talked about the international impact, his emissaries' visits to Ukraine, his visit to Iraq. I mean, you may think of other highlights, but if you think of his impact on the world, I wonder what each of you would draw as the main impact or change that he's brought in terms of social justice issues or international affairs. Who am I going to put on the spot first? Father Damien.
I don't know why you did that. I was just thinking, what on earth am I going to say? Well, I mean, in a sense, you've named those crucial issues, I think. The world suggests people outside the church who have a sense, nevertheless, of who he is and what he's doing. I think people out there would say that this is somebody who's friendly. He is open, and he doesn't constantly sit in judgment on people outside. My background is in working, particularly in dialogue with Muslims. And although Pope St. John Paul II did a very great deal to promote good relationships with Muslims, in many ways, Francis has gone rather further in terms of the risks that he's taken. I mean, Pope St. John Paul II didn't really have to deal so much with the aftermath of 9/11. Francis is inserting his interventions into a world that is profoundly marked by deep suspicion between Christians and Muslims. And he has taken some very bold steps in moving forward at a time, to be honest, as well, when those of us involved in dialogue have rather lost energy. There are fewer Catholics around who are promoting actively interreligious dialogue, particularly with Muslims. That a lot of that sort of appetite of a utopian future, which drove dialogue in the latter part of the 20th century, has rather dissipated. And into that vacuum, Francis has gone with some very, very bold gestures, unprecedentedly close, I think, to key figures in the Muslim world, taking a very considerable risk, again, with those who oppose him most vociferously, and would be very, very keen indeed to tar him with the brush of, you know, being too close to Muslims. So I think I'd pick up on that just to supplement the other points that you've made.
Thank you. Who would like to be next? John, perhaps. I would imagine you're going to say climate change, but you've spoken about poverty in Manchester as well. What kind of global changing initiatives has Pope Francis undertaken in the last 10 years that have imprinted on the world?
I suppose when things come up in the headlines, Pope Francis goes and confronts the question. And so he is outspoken about environment, certainly, and I think has been a wonderful voice in that. And we've got to press on with the urgency with which he says this subject has to be tackled. But yes, whether it's refugees, peace, interfaith dialogue, he's there on the front line and he's meeting people. And it's not sitting back in the Vatican, sort of at a distance. He actually, what was his first trip when he was made Pope was to the I forget the name of it, in South Italy, to see the refugees. landing on the shore, more or less. He's there and he's concerned. I think it shows a very personal, active compassion, which is part of his personality. And I don't think there's any pressing matter which he said doesn't concern me.
How does his leadership filter down to people at grassroots level, Bishop? When, you know, you've got people working in food banks, for example, in your churches in Salford, or working in schools. Is Pope Francis quoted? Is he regarded as a leader who's intimately involved in their motivation for doing it? How does this leadership filter down?
I would say that in my experience, my lifetime, people have been very respectful about talking about the Pope, mentioning him. But in the case of Pope Francis, I'm constantly surprised and delighted by the number of times people seem to refer to Pope Francis with a smile about what he's doing, and maybe a phrase that he said, or reminding us, you know, we've all got our part to play. It just seems he's much more part of the domestic conversation, and his name is mentioned a great deal with affection, but also with that sense of we've got stuff to do, because Pope Francis has told us we've got to get on and do it. And that, I think, is a wonderful reputation for him to have. And that certainly is my experience here in this diocese.
Thank you. Kerry, I wonder, you know, writing as you do about everything based in America, perhaps you could take a question on, you know, the international impact he's made. He, for example, has spoken about Ukraine. He's always speaking about Ukraine and the evils of war. And he's visited many countries. I wonder if you can see from your standpoint as a journalist reporting on his world visits, how you assess his international impact as a world leader.
I think that his commitment to peace and to a peace process in many nations has been noted here. I think kissing the feet of the leaders of South Sudan in an effort for peace was very powerful. I think his desire for peace in Ukraine is very powerful. And then even looking sort of back at history, coming to his Canadian visit, offering an apology to the Indigenous peoples of Canada, these are efforts toward a different kind of peace in a way that I think he's trying to look back at what the church has done and to reflect on that and offer apologies where he can. He's trying to look forward to what the church can do on the international scene in terms of peace and how he can kind of guide that. But he's also a political figure, right? He's the head of a nation state. So that complicates how he's able to interact in some of these conversations as well. And it made him very hesitant to speak out about some aspects of the war in Ukraine as well, which is a challenge, because it is, I think, most people on the international scene see a very obvious side to root for. And he was not obviously sort of expressing an alignment with that for some time. And so he's in a really challenging position, because he also, you know, has the diplomatic route that he's working in that's different and not necessarily seen.
Thank you. But Professor Rollins, could I bring him in just to talk about some of the influence that he's had on morality, moral issues? I know that others may wish to chip in on this. So, for example, he talks about offering the help of sacraments to Catholics living in irregular family situations, which people talk to be divorced or single parent families. When he was speaking about people who are gay, he said, "Who am I to judge them?" I wonder if this kind of could you call it a liberalizing tendency on moral issues has made a big impact both within the Catholic Church as to how people calibrate their decisions that they make on moral issues, but more specifically how the Catholic Church is regarded by others outside
Yeah, I mean, again, a bit like I'm nervous about the idea that the synod is about democratization, I'm nervous about the language of liberalization or liberality in terms of a stance on moral issues. And I think it's understandable that a secular world reaches for that language because it feels like the nearest proximate language they have. But in fact, when you're inside the church structures, it's quite the wrong language. And I think there's a much more interesting issue if you're a Catholic in terms of understanding what Pope Francis is trying to do on those moral issues of, say, the divorced and remarried or LGBTQ individuals. And I think what he's trying to do is to address a deep question about who we think the church is and where we think the church is and what we think and who we think the church is for. And so the tension is between those who imagine that being a member of the church, being identified as church, is those who hit certain targets in terms of their status, their lifestyle, their behaviour, their habits, etc., and individuals who can be judged on some measure not to fall within that register. And I think Francis is saying that's not his understanding of what it means to be a church, to be a pilgrim community on the way towards the kingdom. And so what he's doing is, and it's there in the metaphor, which was not chosen, an image which was not chosen by the Pope, but came up through the process of the synod in October, the image of enlarge your tent, the image of encounter, of travelling together, and the sense that we are church together in that messy, complicated state. And this is back to what Damien was saying about discernment and being a community on the way who are discerning together the life of the Spirit. And I think he wants to take us away from this almost sort of possessive idea of the church, that you can possess the church if you fit certain behavioural characteristics. And he wants to say that this is about the reception of baptism and it's about a community of baptised on the way together and how we accompany each other on that journey. And for him, that drawing close to people, and we've just talked about that in terms of him going to Lampedusa, in terms of drawing near to sites of violence in the world. Bishop Arnold said at the beginning, for Pope Francis, everything's connected. He wants the same logic and practices and experience inside the church as he does outside the church. He doesn't want one ethic for one part of the world and our life in a secular space and another for inside the church. He wants a seamless relationship that's proposed to the world and is lived as a healthy exemplar in the life of the church, such that people can look at the church and think that it's actually an attractional community of Christian witnesses who together are living this life, which is represented, that it bears some relationship to the Gospels. A cardinal very involved in the synod process said to me, and I think it's a beautifully simple and true point, when we were looking at the national reports in October, he said to me, it's as if the people basically want the church to be a little bit like the Jesus of the Gospels. That's what they expect to encounter. And it's in the simplicity of that that people, I think, are drawn to, feeling that there is an integrity about Francis. And the last thing I'd say, which just chimes with some of what Damien was saying on international affairs as well, I was speaking recently to somebody, I'd been giving a talk somewhere, and they contacted me afterwards and said, I'm in this completely unexpected position where I'm not a Catholic, I'm not even sure I'm definitely a Christian, but the only person who I feel speaks for me on the world stage is the Pope. How on earth have I ended up in a position in my life where, as somebody outside of Christian formal structures, I feel this is the person who speaks for me? And I've heard that now on many occasions in different contexts. And it's back to that question of a kind of moral vacuum that we live in terms of leadership on the global stage. And that's why people are attracted to Francis, because it's clear and it's simple and it's there in word and gesture. And he wants this integration between the way the church is and the message that it has to give to the world. And people sense an integrity in that.
I'm going to give the last word to Christopher Lamb. So you've got the inside track, Christopher, on the Vatican. The Pope's not very well. He has something wrong with his knee. He's in a wheelchair. He has this quite punishing sequence of visits abroad and other obligations. But do you think that he will resign early due to ill health, or do we have him in the role for another 10 years at least?
I don't know if it's 10 years, but I think what we've seen recently is the Pope shifting his position on whether he will resign. It looks like he will not resign, that he will stay in the role of Pope for life. He says he's as a job for life, he said, or a ministry for life recently in Africa. And I think the reason why I think the Pope is determined to keep going is because, unlike, this is no criticism of all bishops at all, but unlike some in the church, he has a detachment. There's a detachment from power and ambition. I mean, he never expected to be Pope. And he also turned down, recently revealed, turned down twice chance to be bishop. So I think he's a sense of mission, because he never expected to be in this position. He arrived at the conclave in 2013 with a return ticket to Argentina. And because of that, I think he feels driven to continue for as long as he possibly can. And I think we can expect him to do so, certainly for the short-term future.
Thank you. And thank you to all the panel for giving up an hour of your time to explain all that to us, and everyone for joining our briefing today. Hope you'll join us for briefings in the future. So thanks again. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to the Religion Media Centre podcast. To find out more about us and what we offer, visit our website at religionmediacentre.org.uk. In the meantime, we look forward to welcoming you to our future podcast episodes.